How many enjoyed the extra hour of sleep? Man. Wow, all right. But a couple weeks ago, we started out celebrating our 10th anniversary as a church and celebrating all that God's done, and just taking some time out to say, wow, you know, God, just thank you so much for this journey that you've allowed us to be part of, and looking ahead to all that God's going to do in the future. And that brings us to today, under this banner of celebration that we've been in, where another anniversary has come. And today marks this year anniversary of this journey that our community began called Drive. And 1 year ago today, we declared that neutral wasn't an option for us. It wasn't an option for our lives, and it wasn't an option for our community. And the reason that was significant for us is that we talked about that when you put your car in neutral, really what determines your speed and direction when you're in the car is the contour of the land. What determines your speed and direction is the environment around you. And so that when you're in neutral, you really have only one of two options. You can either sit still or you can coast. But when you're coasting, the only direction that you can go when you're coasting is downhill. And we talked about how, unfortunately, many of us go through life that way, content to just kind of coast through it. But when we're willing to take initiative and change gears and put the car into drive, when we put it into drive, what we're essentially saying is we are going to take responsibility for the direction that we're going. Shifting into drive is saying, you know what, I'm not content to sit still. Shifting into drive is saying, you know what, I'm not content to coast. But I'm going to take responsibility for the direction that we're going. And a year ago, we decided that that's the kind of community we want to be. And so hundreds of people in our community, as part of this journey, sacrificed in a huge way. People sold things. You guys gave up things. You cut back on things. And hundreds of you made a 3-year financial commitment above and beyond our normal percentage giving that we give to our church to fund several specific initiatives that strategically aligned up with the mission of our church. And so what we want to do the next 2 weekends is we want to share some stories. Because as a result of the sacrifices that our community has made and the generosity of this community, already in 1 year, we've been able to give just over $800,000 to these specific initiatives. And as a result, some amazing, amazing things are happening in people's lives. And so we thought it's appropriate that we want to take time just to celebrate that and to look at those and to rejoice over all that God is doing in us and through us, through Drive and through our community. Well, next Sunday, we're going to take some time to focus on the initiatives that are taking place locally, that things that are going on here on our campus and here in the Greater Triangle area. But today, what I want us to do is I want us to focus on our two global initiatives in both Kenya and Haiti. Now, people that are new to our community and they're just kind of catching up with us here in the last year, they often ask me how we decided on Kenya and Haiti as these two specific places in the world. And it was really birthed out of this realization and this desire that we can't fix all of the world's problems. We just can't. But together, if we leveraged our resources, if we leveraged our time, if we leveraged our energy, if we leveraged our problem-solving abilities and capacities, and we focused them in a couple places in the world, we felt God could do something incredibly unique with this community of people. How God, his resources, where he's positioned us in the world, the access to technology that he's given us, we felt like we could do something incredibly unique that would radically impact generations, that could resurrect hope, that could resurrect joy, that could breathe life into people that are often forgotten. And so rather than giving a little bit to a lot of different places, we decided, what would it look like if we gave a ton to just a couple places? And not just give money. Not where we give money just so that we can kind of mark that charity off our list and we can kind of stay at a distance and feel better about ourselves. But we began asking the question, what's it look like for us to get to know these people? What's it look like for us to get to know their names, to get to know their stories? Not where we just visit once and maybe drop off some gifts or just, you know, build a building and then not see them again. But what's it look like to commit there long term? To to become friends with them and to journey with them and to look at every area of their lives and discover how can we partner with God to bring heaven to earth there. And what's it look like to love them holistically in every way possible with no expectations in return? And so we started praying about where God would lead us as a community. And so I started off with three criteria that would help us narrow down where we would land. And the first one was, we wanted that mission or that organization or this group of people that we partnered with, we wanted it to be small enough where we could actually get to know the people, that we could get to know their names, we could spend time with them and get to know them. We didn't want it to be so big that anytime we wanted to try to contact them that we had to go through a bunch of red tape. And there's lots of wonderful organizations out there that do wonderful, incredible things, but sometimes you can't really know exactly where your money goes or exactly in this specific spot, in this specific village, in this specific location, how your money is impacting those specific lives. And so we wanted it to be small enough where we said, you know what, I want to be able to pick up the cell phone and I want to be able to call, you know, the leaders of this particular home or this particular mission. I want to be able to leverage technology so we continue to build relationships with these groups of people even when we're not there in person. I want it to be small enough that our community doesn't have to go through a bunch of red tape, but that we can get to know these people. So that was number one. The second criteria for me was that I wanted to be in a position where this community, we can make a life-changing impact. Again, there's other places where, you know, dozens of people and dozens of organizations are involved, but there are certain places in the world that people don't go for whatever reason, that maybe are considered too dangerous or maybe they're just kind of forgotten. And I say, I want our community to be a part of not just, you know, joining in a little bit where there's already tons being done, but where's no one at? What are those places and how can our community come in and make a huge radical difference that would be life-changing for generations to come? And the third criteria for me was that I wanted someone from our community here at Cross Point to have been on the ground there before we committed to these certain projects and before we committed, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to specific missions. I wanted someone on from our community that had been there and that could vouch for the leadership there and said, you know what, I know their stories, I know who they are, I know their integrity, and I can vouch for where the money is going. And so we started praying over a list of about 20, and it finally got narrowed down to two. The Haitian Children's Home in Jacmel, Haiti, where Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and the Chipema Hope Center in Kenya, this forgotten corner of the world in the bush of Africa. And in the past few months, as many of you know, and you've heard me share a bit about it, and you followed along with me on my blog as I wrote about it as I traveled. I traveled there with a few other leaders from our church to visit both places, to get on the ground in both Haiti and Africa. So with the purpose of that we could begin to get to know them, that we could begin to get to know their stories, that we could know their culture, that we could get to know where they come from, what life is like for them and their environment, but also that we could get to know their hopes, that we could get to know their dreams, that we could begin to discover how as a church we can help and actually be and live out the gospel of Jesus. How we could be the gospel of Jesus in two very much needed places. Christy Doherty and Chris Stoner were two of the people who traveled with me on separate occasions, and recently Stephen Claybrook, our worship pastor, he sat down and he talked with them about some of their experiences, and I wanted you to be able to check out that conversation.
It was like a beautiful resort, and then a war zone had just pummeled it, and I just wasn't prepared for that. I was very surprised by that. Other just kind of fears that I had were leaving my kids behind, going to another country that I just really didn't know what was going to happen there, and flying into Port-au-Prince, knowing that it was kind of rated a very dangerous place to be, just the unknown, just not really knowing, and having never been on a mission trip before, not really knowing what I was getting into. It's just it's so hard to explain the culture and the environment because it's so much different I mean, there are beautiful palm trees, and you feel almost guilty that there's a part of you that feels like, well, this could be like vacation. Mm-hmm. And then you see these people that their homes are these little, you know, metal shacks, and they're sitting on the sidewalk or on the dirt road in front of their home selling oranges or selling just anything and everything that they can to get by, or they're rummaging through trash. And it's just this very strange combination of beauty and despair. You know, we're kind of driving around, and these little kids, my children's ages, you know, 4, 5, 6, these tiny little kids carrying these huge baskets or buckets of water by themselves. There are no parents or adults around, and this is just their job, and it's not unusual for them to head out early in the morning at sunrise, walk however many miles it is that they have to walk to go and get this clean water, load up this gallon, you know, 5-gallon bucket or whatever makeshift thing that they have, and then so much of the water's brown, and so they're carrying, you know, old milk jugs or something full of brown water, and then walking the miles back completely by themselves, you know, these little 4 or 5-year-old kids.
And their family depends on it.
Right. That's their responsibility. That's how they provide for their family at 5 years old.
But we get to this one little compound of homes, and we walk up, and there's this boy, maybe 3 years old, and he's laying on the ground, and our first thought was that he wasn't alive. Flies all over him, and he's laying on their mattress, which is a cow skin, right out in the middle of the blazing sun, and it was really heart-wrenching, and nobody else is around. No family members are around, nothing. We can't find anybody. Start calling out, no one's there. They basically just left him there on his own for the day. I mean, I don't know whether they went out to work, to the fields or whatever, and we just didn't know what to do. We start kind of shaking him to wake him up, and he doesn't respond at all, but we can tell that he's breathing. And a few minutes later, I look over, and Jonathan's kind of kneeled down next to him, and he's got his hand on his shoulder, and he said, I just need to pray for him. Mm-hmm. So he just stopped and prayed for him, and for this little boy that we don't know his name, for his future, for his home, for that he would grow up to know God and love him. You know, that was really, that really impacted me. Mm.
Magdala was born an albino, and so she appears just very normally white. And I wish I could speak more intelligently on this, but I know in the culture, being an albino just means many different negative things. There are some that say that as an albino, it means that you were born from an adulterous relationship. That it's a very heavy voodoo culture, and so there's a lot of issues there, that she just stands out, doesn't fit in anywhere that she goes, and she has all these other issues that she has to worry about. It's tropical sun, and so she has no pigment in her skin, can't really go outside without being burned, and her eyes are burned, and she's just this amazing, loving little girl that all of the kids really just have these unbelievable stories, and I don't use unbelievable lightly. You hear what they come from, the home life that they came from. It's nothing to not have been a street slave or sold out of your family because, like I said, you were maybe the 5th child or the 6th child, and they just can't feed you, and so they sell you as a slave into another family. And if you're not of a certain age yet, then you can't do certain chores, and so they use you in other ways, and that's kind of where Magdala, what she came from, and was just shunned from as a baby because of her having white skin. But she's just this amazing, loving little girl that you can just see that she knows that she's loved. She knows even now that she's a child of God. From interacting, I mean, I only got to spend 4 days with her, but interacting with her, you would just never know what she actually came from.
Well, one of the most exciting things that we did when we were there was to buy the textbooks. And it just kind of was like we can do this. Let's just do it. Because when we went into the classroom and we saw, like, one of the 8th grade classes had 18 students, and they're just sitting there. First of all, they're just sitting there, waiting their turn patiently. They're waiting for one geometry book to make its way around so that everyone has a turn. And we thought, we can buy these books. And so just to sit down with the schoolmaster, the headmaster, and say, what do you need? Tell us what it would take just to give everybody a book in every subject, and then to go out that day and purchase them, to bring them back and give them to them. And the thing that's exciting about that is that how many students just came up, how many kids, and they were like, we will promise that we will study. Thank you for giving us a chance. And to know that all of these students are going to be able to have the tools to really put their lives into their studies, which is something no other school in Kenya does. I mean, they don't offer school books for every student anywhere in Kenya. And so all these kids that we talked to that said, I want to be a doctor or I want to be a teacher, here's one more step towards that. And I'm so excited to be able to go back and just have conversations with them. How are you coming along on this? Or to see kids that are 16 now and they're getting ready to go to high school and know that they're going to be, we're going to get to hear about that. We're going to get to know these kids. I didn't think about that going into it. You know, you meet these orphans and they tell you what they want to do with their life, and then you go home and maybe you never think about it again. But now we get to go back and kind of follow up with them and help to make that happen.
To see that as a church that we've decided to partner with them instead of just send teams just kind of randomly, what an amazing thing that we were able, just while we were there, to see this new home that they were able to buy because of Crosspoint, and just the life conditions. We were able to visit the old home that they were at, and it was downtown in this horrible, dangerous place, and they weren't able to go outside and play. They couldn't, I mean, there was literally the road right in front of them and just heavy traffic, and it was awful. And to get to see that they had land now and the kids could actually go out on kind of their development and play, and just to know that that's what we're partnering with, actual life change. We talk about that and we hear those words kind of as a church, and I just really felt like once we were there, wow, this is what we're able to do just as one church.
There were just 5 of us that went to this trip, and yet the things that we saw that had been changed, the school buildings that had been built with drive money, and the textbooks that were purchased were all just because a lot of people did their part and specifically gave to the drive campaign. But that money went and made a huge impact in one place in the world.
Heard me say it a lot recently, this quote that Shane Claiborne in his book The Irresistible Revolution has, and he says that the problem isn't that the rich don't care about the poor, it's that the rich don't know the poor, and if the rich begin to know the poor, then poverty will come to an end. You know, and it's easy for us sometimes to think of ourselves as not rich, but the reality is that we're extremely rich in the world's eyes, that we really just did to make $35,000 or $40,000 a year puts you in the top 1% globally in the richest people in the world. And so we have to change our perspective and to realize that, yeah, in the global world, we are the rich. And that if the rich can begin to know the poor, poverty will come to an end. And that dream has really been a catalyst. It's been a catalyst for our approach on tackling injustice, not only here in the Triangle, but in both Haiti and Africa, and as well, discovering and asking the question, what's it really look like to get to know these kids? What's it look like to get to know these missionaries and these adults that love and care for them? What's it look like to let God shape a genuine love and concern in our hearts for them that motivates us as a community to be a part of resurrecting hope and joy and life in as many ways imaginable, so that holistic transformation can happen in these two places in such a dramatic way that it will reverberate throughout the globe. But it starts with a community of people. It starts with a community of people just like this that are committed to seeing that kind of radical transformation happen. Now, during my psychology courses back in college, we studied about this certain awareness that develops in infants called object permanence. And basically, the best way to explain it, if you're not familiar with it, is it's that in the first several months of an infant's life, if you hold up an object to an infant and you take it away, psychologists believe that to that infant, that object no longer exists. That once it's out of sight, once it's out of view, then it ceases to exist in their mind. And psychologists believe that's what contributes to early separation anxiety between children and their moms. That when mom leaves the room, mom ceases to exist in that infant's mind. And so it creates a sense of fear or a sense of panic. But over time, and typically somewhere they believe around 8 to 9 months, this awareness develops that's been labeled as object permanence, where you begin to understand that even if an object isn't in your immediate view, it still exists. You're aware that it's there. A while back, I was reading a book by an author named Gary Hagen, and it was called The Good News About Injustice, and he got me thinking about something similar, and I started thinking about the implications for our community. And I started to dream about that one of the things I would love for our community to be marked by is that in a very similar way, we would develop this great sense of what he calls compassion permanence. Compassion permanence, that just because incredible needs and poverty and injustice aren't maybe immediately in our view for whatever reason here in Cary, North Carolina, that we wouldn't have this default mentality to acting and living like they don't exist. But rather, we would let God develop this compassion permanence in us. This awareness in us that inspires us to actually do something about it. To be strategic about it, to be creative about it, to be holistic about it. Not just here's some money and here's some food, but to think through and to really think through everything that contributes to genuine hope and transformation of specific lives in the community they live in. And that's what we've been doing this past year. And what we continue to do is leaders every day, and that I hope just, you know, reverberates out through our community, that we all own this mission that God's called us on together. I was talking with Danny Pye, who's the missionary there in Haiti and the dad to these 25 kids that we've come alongside, and we were wrestling through with him some of the implications that once we realized that most of these kids, many of these kids specifically in Haiti, that a lot of them have been sexually abused in their past. They've gone through physical abuse, been all sorts of abuse, but many of them sexually abused because they were, when they were on the streets, they were often sold into slavery. And it just hit me one day that for us, it can't just be about let's feed them and clothe them and educate them. But for these specific group of kids, if we want to see holistic transformation happen in their lives, then we've got to figure out a way to help them deal with that. We've got to figure out a way to get counseling for these kids for all that they've been through, that if they have any hope of having great marriage relationships someday, not to mention just normal trust relationships in general, then some type of, you know, pretty intense counseling has to be a part of that. Now, I don't know exactly how that happens. It's not a one-time thing. You send a counselor down and it's good. But long-term, if our community is going to focus on this one place in the world, in this one area, then we've got to figure out how's that a part of the equation. How do we help make that happen? Because that's going to be key. When we were in Africa, we were looking at this new school that we've been able to build. And you've seen pictures of it. And I can't tell you the difference that it's going to make. I mean, the school building that they're in now currently, and you've seen pictures on my blog where you've got these wooden posts and this tin sheeting that's kind of wrapped around it, and, you know, flooding's taking place all underneath, and so the kids have kept getting sick, and, you know, disease and all sorts of things have been creeping in, as well as animals, into their school environment. Just a terrible environment for them to try to learn. And so in building this new school building, that this wonderful new environment for them to learn in is going to make such a huge difference for these 70 orphans that go to that school. And not only for them, there's actually 30 kids from the surrounding villages out in the bush that come and travel to go to this one private school. And so it's impacting other families and rippling out in that community of what we do there. But one of the things that we started to realize And as we play this movie forward, what's it need to really educate these kids? It's not just about building them a building. And so that birthed this idea of getting them books. These kids that have dreams of being doctors and lawyers and politicians and leaders in their country to help initiate change. Well, then we need to come alongside them and we need to get them books. They need to study. And so, you know, we purchased all these books, as Chris said, to say every kid in every subject, no school in Kenya, primary school in Kenya has that. So one of the great things now is that they have an incredibly attractive situation to learn in, but they need great teachers. They need quality teachers to come and to educate them. It's not just a matter of giving them books. And so then you're faced with the reality. Well, you're out in the middle of the bush. And so in order to attract great teachers, you have an incredible situation that teachers want to come to, but teachers have to be able to have a place to stay. And so we've got to think about that because they're out in the middle of nowhere. And so teachers would actually have to move there. Now, and the reality, it doesn't cost that much money, you know, in comparison to what it cost here to build those types of homes. $20,000 builds two duplex homes to house two teachers' families on the ground in Africa. But we have to think through that. We have to say, okay, this is a holistic picture. This is a mission. We can't just say, okay, we built a building, but we've got to think through what's it really look like to educate these kids and to resurrect hope and joy there. You see, we have to see the whole picture. And to see the whole picture, we have to think about the big things as well as the little things that bring life, that shine light into very dark corners of the world. You know, one of the things, speaking of little things, that shocked me down in Haiti was that these kids live in an island nation surrounded by water, and most of them spend their whole lives and never see the ocean. Few minutes from the ocean and never seen it. But not just the ocean. Come to find out that not one of these kids in this home in Haiti had ever seen a swimming pool. Not only seen a swimming pool, never had been in one. So while we were down there, Danny, the missionary, struck this deal with the hotel manager and took a lot of convincing because they have, the hotel where we're staying in, a lot of UN workers come in there. And, you know, by American standards, the hotel is just kind of average, but for Haiti, it's resort quality. And so a lot of UN dignitaries stay there. And so the idea of 25 orphans coming in and taking over the pool, it wasn't too appealing to management. But Danny just struck this deal with him and convinced him that this would be a good idea. And so one afternoon, I'll never forget the look on these kids' faces the first time they got to see this swimming pool. And they just leaped into it, and the thrill and the joy that took over their face of just splashing around, celebrating life, being kids. And even more so, we were able to, you know, get French fries for all the kids. There's a restaurant there in the hotel, and get French fries for them and Coca-Cola for them. And we just threw this huge party, and it was this incredible reminder for me that God has called us there into these specific places in the world, not just to prolong survival, not just to prolong existence, but to bring life in every way Jesus intended life to be. This best life imaginable. Same thing hit me in Africa a few weeks later, where on the first day of the orphanage, we walk into the kitchen and there's this huge vat of just dirty, nasty smelling water that's being boiled. And come to find out, that's what the kids drink. That's what they live off of. And they just don't know any different. And so as a part of Drive, we had funded a project that's been going on the last several months to try to pipe in clean water to the orphanage, to bring it down a mountainside and pipe it out from the ground. And so it's just taken a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of pipe being laid for long distances to bring clean water here. But in the months leading up to before we had arrived there on the ground, they'd had a lot of problems where the pipe had kept bursting and they couldn't get it to work. And so there are all sorts of difficulties. And so while we were there on the ground for about three focused days, Greg Stoner, one of our elders, and a couple others of the kids and a few of us spent practically the entire time trying to figure out, how do we solve this problem? How do we get clean water there? And so finally, on the last day, just about an hour before we left, we had plans to leave right after church on Sunday to drive back to Nairobi. And we were like, well, let's give this one last shot. We think we can figure it out of what we need to get this thing to happen. And all of a sudden, it works. And we get this piece and it fits together and clean water starts gushing out. And I'm telling you, sometimes when you see kids, you know, here in America, and you see them, they look, they're eating something so fast, and you're like, it looks like they've never had food before. You see them drinking, it's like they've never drank before. But to see these kids dive to that water and to cup their hands and to just start gulping it in this extreme just joy and thrill that just took over their faces of this seeing this very clean water. It was just this amazing, amazing picture. And I thought about that when Jesus referred to himself as living water. Somehow I imagine this kind of water was much more like the picture he was wanting to paint for people when they thought of Jesus as being this living water, not dirty, boiled water that they had been used to. And the things that I get excited about and think about is that bringing clean water into that area that's never had it before, it not only impacts those kids' lives, but it will reverberate throughout the surrounding villages where families and huts all throughout the bush and up on the mountainside will now be able to hike and get clean water to their families where they've never had it before. It reverberates out. It's changing people's lives. So as we start to wrap this up, I want to take a few moments just to point to a couple things. One, to those of you that have been faithfully giving to Drive, that have sacrificed so much over this last year, I just want to say thank you. I want to say thank you on behalf of our community, and I want to say thank you on behalf of Africa and Haiti. I talked to the leader in Haiti this morning and just wanted me to tell you thank you. So thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for what you've sacrificed. And I hope that today inspires you to take some time to allow yourself to celebrate and to rejoice all that God is doing through you and what God is allowing us to be a part of. And I just want to encourage you to keep giving, to continue to be faithful as you have, because we haven't completed all of our projects yet. And the only thing that's stopping the projects that we've committed to is funding, that they're ready to go. They're ready to pull the trigger on buildings, on building the new dormitories for the kids and tackling all the different projects that we've outlined. And as soon as the funds come in, then you trust that we're going to send them out. We're not holding on to the money. We want things to happen. To those of you that maybe have started coming to our community, you know, somewhere in the last year, and you're saying, you know what, I want to be a part of something like this. I want to be a part of something bigger than myself. Then we've got packets out here that we all went through as a community, these Drive packets, and in them has a DVD that explains kind of this mission and journey we've been on. It has a prayer journey that we went through as a church, books and commitment cards where we invited people to make a 3-year commitment. But obviously, if you wanted to join in now, we'd encourage you to make a 2-year commitment to this and say, you know what? Yeah, I've got no qualms and inviting you to say, you know what? This is something awesome that you could be a part of that is contributing to real radical life change in people's lives. And so if you want to do that, there'll be outside on a table right here in this hallway. You can pick one of those up and take it home with you. The last thing I want to point you to is directly with the kids and the sponsorship of these kids in both Haiti and Africa. One of our goals is that we get every single kid sponsored by an individual family, whether it's in our community or in other churches. And we say, you know what, we want to be able to, once we get the basic necessities met, we want to educate them and feed them and clothe them. And then we want to dream bigger and we want to figure out what's that look like and how do we tackle other projects. And we're going to continue to do that. Just this last week, you know, when one of the things I was down there, I watched for hours, for 2 straight days, nannies, all they did was wash clothes by hand. And so you'll be happy to know, Crosspoint, out of our 10% mission giving this week, is sending the biggest washing machine that money can buy down to Haiti and saying, let's fix that, you know? That's something we can do. And, you know, it doesn't take much for us to make a huge difference. And now those nannies are going to be able to focus more time on just loving these kids and nurturing them and coming alongside them rather than spending hours upon hours upon hours washing clothes by hand. We can fix problems. We can put our heads together. But at the same time, we want to make sure these kids are well taken care of and that they're sponsors. And I can't tell you the difference sponsorship makes in seeing these kids and seeing it lived out. Sometimes you maybe see it on TV and you're thinking, yeah, I mean, if I sponsor a kid, does that really make a difference? I'm telling you, I saw kids weep when they talked about their sponsors. In Africa, they called them their Good Samaritans and saying, one day I hope that I'll get a Good Samaritan. because they see the incredible difference, and they know the incredible difference that it makes in their lives. And so one of the things that I love, too, about these two specific homes of kids that we've partnered with is that they take older kids. Very few orphanages in both Africa and Haiti take kids over the age of 7. Because there's lots of problems that you could understand come along with that. In Haiti, one of the things we've talked about, when you talk about sexual abuse and you talk about those things that happen, there's lots of implications that, you know, that play out in people's lives. And so lots of people just avoid older kids. And these two specific places said, no, you know, we want to be a part of resurrecting these kids' lives and hope and joy. And we're going to partner with them. And all the mess maybe that comes with, we're going to wrap our arms around them. So I love that. And sometimes when you get, you know, you look at sponsorship things, people like to have sponsorship packets with little kids because obviously they're stinking cute, you know. They're like 2 and 3 years old and you're just like, oh, look at this little one. But to say, yeah, what's it look like to come alongside a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old that has dreams and hopes of going to high school and going to college and has dreams of being the next president of their country and saying, you know what, that kid is the kid that's going to be definitely forgotten, left out, and said, you know what, yeah, we'll start with the little ones. But the problem is the little ones, they get sponsored usually for a while to the point when they get up to elementary school or junior high and they're kind of thought, oh, well, they'll be on their own. They'll make it now and let's get another little kid. And so for us, I'm so thankful that it's strategic on the part of our community to say, let's go and partner with these older kids. And so there's packets right outside here, too, for kids in both Haiti and in Africa. And then if you're interested in that, those are available to you. And I'm telling you, the great thing about that is you can look at each of these kids and like this girl, Magdala here, you know what? I can tell you exactly where that money's going. And I can tell you, you know what? I've hugged this kid. I've sang with this kid and I've danced with this kid. I know exactly who she is, how you can contact her. You know exactly where she is. Even more than that, you're going to have more than enough opportunities to go and see her yourself, to partner with her, to wrap your arms around her. You know, in Africa, same thing, this little girl, Jennifer, you know, I remember laughing with her and sitting around with her in a circle. This isn't a kid, some random place in the world that you'll never know and you might send letters to and you don't know if it ever comes back. These are kids that you can go visit, that you can send specific things to and to sponsor and to know and to love and to know their story and to get to know them and see the radical difference that it will make in their lives. And so I just want to encourage you, if that's something that you and your family say, you know what, this is a great step and a way for us to get to know people that desperately need it and to love them in a tangible way, then I'd love it. I'd love it when we get to the point when every kid in both of those orphanages, all 90 kids, are all taken care of and they're all sponsored. And then we can put our brains together and to figure out how we can bring more holistic change to those regions of the world. Because when the rich know the poor, I'm convinced poverty will come to an end. And friends, we can't fix every problem in the world. We just can't. But in these two places, we can do something. And we can do something huge that will reverberate out across the globe. Why don't you pray with me for a moment? Father, I thank you for these stories of life change that you've given us the privilege to be a part of. Father, I pray that you would develop this sense of compassion permanence in us. That, Father, we wouldn't live our lives like great need and poverty and injustice doesn't exist because we don't see it right in front of us. But, Father, Father, you would burn our hearts with that, and that you would help us to realize how rich we are, and you would help us to realize how much we can do and the difference we can make. Father, I thank you that we can be strategic about this, that it makes sense than saying what could happen over the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years when we say in these two places in the world, what can happen, God? And I thank you that you allow us to be a part of that. Father, may we be your hands and may we be your feet. Father, may we partner with you in being the gospel in these two places in the world and living it out, Father, so that people will come to know you and that your name would reverberate out across the globe. Father, we do this because we love you and we know that these are people that you have called us to love. So, Father, may we do it extravagantly and creatively and strategically. And may you, Father, get all the glory from it. In the name of Jesus, amen.
Tell me about anything that you're thankful for God for and what God's done in your life.
Merci, bon bagay, ou te mande bon Dieu. Il te fait vraiment, il te content parce que te ba ou li.
Te mande bon Dieu, nan prière, te mande bon Dieu. Te mande bon Dieu comme beaucoup à accepté Jésus. Vraiment prier, bon Dieu te sauve, il te vint mettre là, grâce à Dieu, m'ka vivre. M'a gen chance, et m'pense, un jour, bon Dieu a fait. M'kwe bon Dieu pa kite m'pov, et la mette nan fami nan pou moun la kay mwen yo ka wè ka sezi de mwen et m pense bon Dieu a fait travail nan la vie et bon Dieu a pè de ma la vie.
What really God made in my life is before I wasn't here, I had a prayer with God. I said, God, I want to come to you, I want to serve you, and I didn't really know how. But God brought me here, and I have this family, who is a family Christian, and helped me out, and also helped me out in every sense, and feed me, and give me education, and that really made me happy. And I am sure later on, my family, those who are ashamed of me, one day they will be proud of me, because I am here, I am working with God, and God hopefully will help me to have a better future tomorrow.